You ever watch this guy on television?
You all were not telling the truth, and you should not be trusted.
Congressman Matt Gaetz, thank you for what you did for your country tonight.
Be offended with the Democratic whip, not House Republicans.
Like a machine, Matt Gaetz.
Welcome to Hot Takes. I'm Congressman Matt Gaetz. Let's talk about the news. Coronavirus task force members are testifying before a Senate Health Committee today. I'll break down the information you want to know regarding testing and the key work we've got to do as a country to rebuild our public health infrastructure. Also, last night, Trey Gowdy confronted with some of the concerns that I had that I reflected on in the last podcast about his support of the FBI back in 2018. We'll talk about his admission that he made a mistake during that time. What are the consequences and downstream impacts of that mistake in our efforts to hold folks accountable? Rick Grenell, making information available that I have been calling on for a year. The Russia hoax transcripts. This information is going to be key to telling us who was involved in unmasking, who knew what when, and I think we'll find out the key members of the Obama administration who were working to destabilize the Trump presidency both before and after his election. But first, I want to thank the thousands of you who downloaded our podcast yesterday. I'm sort of new to the podcast game. I want to thank my good friend Charlie Kirk over at Turning Point USA for encouraging me to launch a podcast. I'll be on Charlie's show, The Charlie Kirk Show, available for download later today. I'm sure that'll be a blast. I also want to thank those of you who left your thoughts, reviews, and comments over at the National Pulse. Raheem Kassam, who also is one of the hosts of the War Room Pandemic podcast, called Hot Takes interesting. So we'll take that. Thanks, Raheem. Not everyone loved it. I'll say that. Apparently I'm not for everyone, and this show may not be for everyone. Probably the meanest review we got was the individual who posted on Twitter that they would rather eat a COVID sundae covered in AIDS sprinkles than listen to my podcast. First, a COVID sundae covered in AIDS sprinkles would be very high carb right now. And since, you know, the gyms aren't open, folks aren't getting out and, you know, playing basketball, playing sports as much in a team environment, I would not suggest a sundae at this point in time. Also, we're seeing more and more evidence from our public health officials that obesity is a top comorbidity, indicating someone is likely to have severe consequences of the coronavirus. So if you were going to have a COVID anything, you would not want a COVID sundae. Maybe like some COVID kale. But on a more serious note, today the COVID task force was giving testimony before the Senate Health Committee, and Dr. Redfried was there giving key public health information regarding the importance of our healthcare infrastructure. Let's listen in to what the good doctor had to say.
We need to rebuild our nation's public health infrastructure. Data and data analytics, public health laboratory resilience, and our nation's public health workforce. Now's the time to put it in place for the generations to come, not only for the public health system that our nation needs, but for the public health system that our nation deserves.
That analysis is, I think, central to not only our public health mission, but really our overall strategic mission when it comes to medical equipment, ensuring that we are ready for the next virus from a mobilization standpoint that is akin to a military mobilization. We saw the need for that now, and so I think that is a great direction to the Congress going forward. Also, we heard from Dr. Gregoire regarding the advancements in testing, the millions of tests that have been done in our country, the fact that we lead the world in the number of tests done. Let's listen into that important testing information.
On March 12th, Secretary Azar requested that I lead the COVID-19 testing efforts within HHS. Since then, the nation has performed more than 9 million COVID-19 tests, a number far greater than any other country, and double the per capita test performed to date in South Korea.
We also heard from Dr. Fauci. Let's listen to this exchange he had with the Senate.
You might recall in this committee that in January of this year, I said that it would take about 1 year to 18 months if we were successful in developing a vaccine. The NIH trial moved very quickly. On January 10th, the sequence was known. On January the 11th, the Vaccine Research Center met to develop a plan. On the 14th of January, we officially started the vaccine development.
Rick Grenell, the current acting director of National Intelligence, is making big news. Grenell has gone into this role with really a dustbuster mentality to find the information that needs to be before the American people and to get it out, to not sit on it anymore. I would suggest that acting director Grenell has done more to expose the truth than any member of the Trump administration has ever done. And now he's naming names. That's right. We will soon be learning the information regarding who in the Obama administration participated in the unmasking of General Flynn and I think other corrupt motivators for the Trump-Russia investigation that we all now know to be an absolute hoax. So congratulations to Director Grenell. But I think it's really important to understand what has brought us up to this moment where we've got this flood of disclosures that will soon be coming out and finally revealing the truths that Jim Jordan and Mark Meadows and Devin Nunes and myself have been talking about for a number of years regarding the unprecedented and unscrupulous efforts to undermine President Trump and to try to steal this election away from the voters. So Grenell obviously is in this position because it had become vacant. The original director of national intelligence for the Trump administration was Dan Coats. Dan Coats was easy to confirm, and he's also easy to forget because he didn't release any of this information that we're now finally getting that is just so key to understanding the corruptness of the Russia investigation. I mean, you just think what we've learned since we've been in quarantine. You know, I mean, before we went into COVID quarantine, we didn't know that the sub sources of the Steele dossier were actually the targets of Russian intelligence. We've now just since learned that. I mean, we didn't know when we started quarantine that even as the FBI was going to investigate Flynn, they were speculating as to whether or not the whole deal was a setup. And when we went into quarantine, we didn't know that back in 2017, the Intelligence Committee of the House was taking testimony where people like McCabe and Brennan were admitting that there was no evidence to suggest that President Trump was colluding with Russia or acting at the behest of Russia or serving as a Russian agent. We've just learned all that now, like during this bizarre period in human history where we've all been in some varying degree of COVID quarantine. And you got to ask yourself, why the hell didn't we learn this information in real time? Like, why did we allow the American people to even doubt whether or not our president was a patriot serving our country or whether he was, as Adam Schiff and Eric Swalwell and, you know, Chuck Schumer were alleging, you know, possibly an agent of the Russian government. That stuff was ridiculous, and we knew it at the time. And so Dan Coats is there serving as the director of national intelligence. He has precisely the same information that Director Grenell has now that he's getting out into the public square. But Coats doesn't release any of it. And so here's a clip from me from 1 year ago, almost a year ago to the day from right now. We're back in May of 2019. I am calling on Dan Coats to release the information that we are now only receiving.
We haven't had the Director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats, actually lay out for us what was in the transcripts taken by the House Intelligence Committee where they interviewed Clapper, where they interviewed Comey and McCabe and Brennan. And we ought to have that information. He's been sitting on it for 4 months, and we need to get it out.
Fascinating. I didn't know that, and I'm
over
grateful to hear.
Over 50 transcripts have been voted out of the House Intelligence Committee to be declassified so that we can get to the bottom of where the lies existed and how this terrible investigation
started. So why hasn't Coats made those public?
4 months. We're still waiting.
So as we know, Coats doesn't respond to my call to release this information. Imagine how much better things would be in terms of our clarity and our understanding of the truth had he actually done that at the time. But he doesn't. And so he ultimately leaves. And then President Trump nominates for the DNI position my good friend, fellow House Judiciary member, John Ratcliffe. You guys will remember Ratcliffe was spectacular during the impeachment process, applying his understanding of intelligence with his understanding of the law as a former U.S. attorney, and then having the ability to really question witnesses in a way that framed up these important issues that allowed us to expose impeachment, expose the Russia hoax in real time. So Trump nominates Ratcliffe, And it becomes very clear upon that initial nomination that John Ratcliffe, despite his qualifications, despite his abilities, is not going to get the Senate support of key Republicans. And the low-key message back on that was that Ratcliffe was too aggressive. He was too eager. He was too, frankly, he was probably too effective at carving up these people like Peter Strzok and Rod Rosenstein and Robert Mueller. And some senators didn't like that. They didn't think that was sufficiently austere. And so, you know, without the strong support of a lot of the Republicans that we were going to need to get Ratcliffe confirmed at that time, Ratcliffe said, look, let me go back and focus on my work in the House and not be just a punching bag over in the Senate. So he comes back, continues to do great work. But then, with the position still open, there's the ability to move any other Trump administration official who has received confirmation in their current job into that position. And I'll just tell you, like the guy in the Trump administration that is the dustbuster, that will go in and clean house and will not kowtow to the way things used to be, is Ambassador Rick Grenell, who was serving us very valiantly in Germany, representing our country's interests. So President Trump moves Ambassador Grenell into the acting DNI position, and the left goes crazy. They know what's coming. They know what they're going to get with Grenell, that the truth is going to come out. And so the day that this is the big news, that Trump is putting Grenell in this position, I go on The View. That's right, ABC's The View. And this is the exchange that I had on The View about Ambassador Grenell.
Trump announced he's appointing another loyalist of his, Rick Grenell.
On Rick's qualifications, 8 years at the UN, 2 years in Germany.
Yeah.
He advised the Security Council. Yeah. And Berlin, where he was active, is one of the hotbeds of intelligence activity. Nothing happens there without the chief of station ambassador working together. So Rick Grenell is very qualified.
So I think it is a breakthrough appointment.
Okay,
yeah, that's my argument.
So I stuck up for Rick Grenell on The View, and I just could not be prouder of the fantastic work that he's doing as acting director of DNI. But he's acting. So what does President Trump do? Brilliantly. I mean, this is like art of the deal to the max. He then re-nominates Ratcliffe for the permanent position. So now, like, the people who might not have loved Ratcliffe because he's aggressive and effective and is really going to expose the truth, well, now those people have a choice, right? Either they can vote for Ratcliffe or they can leave Grenell in the current position, and he's just going to keep rolling through these disclosures. And so I have ultimate confidence that we are seeing a massive upgrade at the DNI position, and that we will see that in an enduring way going forward, because either the Senate's going to confirm Ratcliffe, which they should, and he knows where all the bodies are buried, and he's going to get all of this out in the open, or they can leave Rick Grenell there. And the news of the day is that Grenell has handed over to Bill Barr the declassifications so that we can finally learn who in the Obama administration was specifically involved in the unmasking of Michael Flynn. And that's going to tell us who was driving the train in the Obama administration to construct the entire Russia hoax to begin with. And all of this is happening at the same time that you've got the Durham investigation going on, really tweezing through the corrupt origins of the Russia investigation, the predication for it. And I'm just very confident now that with finally the right people with the right gumption in the right place, that we're going to get the job done, and then it's going to happen. Now, that brings us to my discussion about Trey Gowdy. Trey Gowdy was the brilliant lawyer who in 2017 served on the Intelligence Committee and got all these admissions from the IC about the lack of basis for the Russia investigation. But then in 2018, Gowdy goes on television in the month of May and says, you know, the FBI did nothing wrong. None of this had anything to do with Trump. And we should all just trust the FBI, trust our institutions, trust Robert Mueller, and everything's going to be okay. And as soon as Gowdy does that, then Paul Ryan goes out and parrots the same thing. So you can only imagine if you're a Jim Jordan or a Matt Gaetz or a Lee Zeldin or an Andy Biggs, and you're out there every night saying, there's something rotten in Denmark, this deal is corrupt, and then news anchors are feeding you back the words of Trey Gowdy and Paul Ryan and saying, well, Gowdy says everything's fine. So what do you, Matt Gaetz, know that Trey Gowdy doesn't know? And it made it very difficult for us. And so here's the big news. Last night, Trey Gowdy goes on Tucker Carlson Tonight And Tucker really presses him on these issues. And let's listen to that exchange.
You were briefed by the FBI in 2018, and shortly after that briefing came on this channel to describe your reaction to it. Here's what you said then.
But as of now, I think Chris Wray and Rod Rosenstein are stunned whenever people think Trump is the target of their investigation. I'll leave it up to them how to brief the president or how to brief his lawyers.
Was that point of view that you're talking about right now, was that strengthened when you went into this briefing last week?
Yes. I am even more convinced that the FBI did exactly what my fellow citizens would want them to do when they got the information they got, and that it has nothing to do with Donald Trump.
I remember watching that and thinking, boy, I hope he's right. Do you still feel that way?
Oh, gosh, no. No, I made a lot of mistakes in life relying on briefings and not insisting on the documents. It took me about 3 weeks. I went over to the Department of Justice. I sat there for 4 hours. That's when I saw that Peter Strzok actually initiated and approved Crossfire Hurricane. That's when I saw the exculpatory information on George Papadopoulos. That's when I saw for the very first time that it was the Trump campaign mentioned in that predicate document. They've been telling us all along, Trump's not the target, the campaign's not the target. So, yes, my mistake was relying on the word of the FBI and the DOJ and not insisting on the documents.
Right.
Luckily, it took me about 3 weeks to correct that mistake.
It is not often that a member of Congress or even a former member of Congress admits their mistakes, but frankly, I think it's a sign of strength. You know, when I screw up, when I make a mistake, I try to say, I'm sorry, I'll try to do better next time. I think that every human being has an error rate, and it's always good when we can acknowledge that because I think it makes it more productive for us to move forward. So Gowdy last night admits that it was a mistake for him to essentially take up for the FBI as those of us who were more aggressive, who I think perhaps had more foresight into what was really going on, were trying to get accountability applied. And the cost of that mistake is really something that I think we've got to understand, because we had sent all of these document requests to Rod Rosenstein and Christopher Wray to get the necessary information to expose the liars and crooks and thieves over there. And they would delay, and then they would redact. And like, finally, we were at the point where we had this, I believe, the support from the rank and file members of the Republican conference to hold these people in contempt if necessary, and to potentially even start impeaching officials within the administration that weren't complying with our requests to get to the bottom of the corrupt Russia hoax. I mean, that was seriously something under consideration with a lot of the conference. But then when Gowdy and Ryan go in a back room and meet with Rosenstein and Christopher Wray, Rosenstein and Wray essentially sell him a bill of goods, and instead of using the leadership skills to ask tough questions, to demand direct review of documents, to have access to witnesses, they just took their word for it. And I do think that that failure of leadership does not have a temporary impact on our ability to hold these people accountable. It might, in fact, be the permanent reason why folks get away with stuff that they otherwise wouldn't have gotten away with had we had the ability to actually run all these leads to ground. So I'm glad Trey admitted this was a mistake. Trey remains a brilliant lawyer. I still think he's a good guy. But this was something that that really cost us a lot. And, perhaps next time, if there is a circumstance where, you know, some of the members like Jim Jordan and myself raise these concerns to leadership, we hope that they won't dismiss us and take the word of the people who are acting corruptly against the president another time around. You know, that's all we can hope, is that we learn from those mistakes. But what about Paul Ryan? Trey Gowdy has admitted his mistake, but shouldn't Paul Ryan admit his? Matter of fact, it was Paul Ryan who, just after Gowdy made the claims that we should all trust the FBI, came out and said he agreed with Gowdy. He agreed with those assessments. So I'm glad Gowdy has admitted his mistake. I think that the next time Paul Ryan has an interview, a reporter should ask him whether or not he regrets not giving us subpoena power, whether he regrets just taking the FBI's word for it in light of the fact that he was relying on Gowdy, and Gowdy now has in fact recanted those views and reflected on them with some regret. Jeff Sessions sends an open letter to the people of Alabama today regarding his time as Attorney General. I think that has some very significant historical context, and so I want to talk about it. I want to talk about that letter, about my experience with Jeff Sessions as a member of the Judiciary Committee that oversees the work of the Justice Department that he led, and some of the interactions I had with him, which were just downright bizarre, and why I think this letter is pretty bizarre itself. I'll start by saying I think that Jeff Sessions was a great senator. When you look at his views on immigration, being pro-law enforcement, I think that he made a number of good calls there and did a good job. But, I mean, as Attorney General, woof. You know, I mean, he showed political courage coming out and supporting the president. I think he was one of the first, or if not the first, U.S. senator to back Trump, came out to that big rally in Mobile. And really, a lot of the work that came out of Sessions' office as a senator, I think, and I suspect, can likely be traced back to the brilliant mind of Stephen Miller, who, of course, now is a senior policy advisor to the president. I mean, Stephen Miller is one of the smartest people I have ever interacted with. I'm always like just gleeful when I can steal a few moments of his time to ask his perspective on issues. And he worked for Sessions, and I think he made Sessions look very, very good. I don't even know if Miller might have had a role in sort of talking to Sessions about getting with Trump, because Stephen has that kind of foresight, that kind of intellect, and I think you know, the ability to really understand how policy and politics interact with one another. So I talked to the president once about Sessions while he was, I think Sessions was Attorney General at the time. And I mean, you know, the president said that when he went to the rally in Mobile and Sessions shows up, that Trump didn't even know who Sessions was. I mean, he didn't even know, like, who is this guy? Apparently he's a senator who wants to endorse you. And so then when Trump wins, you know, I mean, I think that he didn't exactly go into, the president-elect didn't exactly go into Washington with some massive Rolodex of every person in D.C. and what they had done and what their capabilities were. If anything, the president won because he was not of Washington. He was not of that world. And Sessions was a guy that had shown early loyalty, had shown some political courage. And so the president wanted to include him in his administration. And the president once shared with me that he said, like, look, I mean, we offered him anything but attorney general. I mean, we wanted to give him a number of other jobs in the administration. And just over and over again, Sessions just wanted to be attorney general. That was it. That was his sole focus. And ultimately, they decided to give him a chance. And the president shared with me that to this day, he still believes that that was the worst personnel move that he ever made, was offering the attorney general position to Jeff Sessions, that was just a totally unnecessary dearth of leadership that we allowed to serve in a role that was so critically important as people were trying to really convert our own government into a political operation against the person that the voters had selected. I mean, that is what was going on, and Sessions did not have the ability to handle that. Let's go back and hear some of the president's reflections in his own words.
Jeff Sessions was a disaster. He was so bad in his nomination proceedings, I should have gotten rid of him there. He knew less about Russia than I did. He knew nothing about Russia. Jeff was just very weak and very sad. And when the name Russia was mentioned, just the word Russia, he immediately, instead of being a man and saying, this is a hoax, he recused himself.
So it's clear the president doesn't have confidence in Jeff Sessions as a leader. And I'll just share with you the story of why I don't have any confidence in Jeff Sessions. It was July of 2017. And after taking just relentless incoming from the Democrats regarding, oh, Trump, Russia, Michael Flynn, all the stuff we now know to be nonsense, after all that was going on, you had a desire from the House Republicans to actually start punching back, you know, to actually use the tools the Democrats are using against us and actually get out there and fight this fight rather than just taking the incoming, which was seemingly the Jeff Sessions, Paul Ryan view of the world. So Jim Jordan and Ron DeSantis and Andy Biggs and myself and Mike Johnson and a number of other members of the House Judiciary Committee sent Sessions a letter saying, we think that a special counsel should be appointed not to investigate the president, but to investigate all of the corruption that swirls around the efforts to delegitimize the president to the benefit of the Clintons, whether that's using the Clinton Foundation as an international money laundering operation, or whether that was Hillary Clinton's illegal violations of law disclosures of classified information. But no, nobody wanted to get into that over at the Department of Justice. And so instead, Jeff Sessions calls a meeting. He calls, you know, those of us like Jordan and myself over to the Department of Justice. It was my first time going over there so that we could talk through what he believed was the right use of the department bringing people to account, and whether or not there would be a double standard, you know, one for the president and one for, you know, those who were viewed as untouchable because they were part of permanent Washington. So we go over there, and I mean, it was just like, you know how you just walk into a room sometimes and you could tell who's in charge and who isn't. And almost all of us to a person on the congressional side, like, got the sense that the inmates were running the asylum over there at the Department of Justice, that Jeff Sessions wasn't the leader, that he was like, you know, an employee over there. I mean, as some of the deputies and as some of the bureaucrats and as some of the permanent department people were lecturing us about why they weren't going to do what we asked and apply the same standard to both sides of the 2016 presidential election, Jeff Sessions was literally standing over in the corner asking if people wanted sugar with their coffee and tea. Now, again, kind Southern gentleman, good guy, but like, that is not the person you want running the Department of Justice, especially at a time when people were trying to weaponize elements of the FBI and the Department of Justice against the duly elected president of the United States. So I agree with the president that, like, Jeff Sessions belongs in a commercial for low tea before he belongs back at the highest levels of the United States government based on just his lackluster performance and his inability to marshal some leadership over there at the Department of Justice. So let's break down this letter that he sends today to the people of Alabama, why he's in the news. He says, and I'm quoting from the letter, "I was a central figure in the campaign and was also a subject and a witness in the investigation." And here he's justifying his recusal. But like, what in the world does that mean? He was the subject in the investigation? They were investigating Jeff Sessions? I mean, like, if you really believed you were the subject of the investigation and you're the attorney general, you don't recuse yourself from that investigation. You resign. You resign. Now, Sessions was never a subject. He was never a relevant witness. I mean, he had like a passing, glancing, handshake with some Russian, and they saw how weak he was. And so they used that as a way to get him out of the way so that there would be no political leadership at the Department of Justice. That was the whole deal. So Sessions was too weak to push back, but then he was also too confused to just resign, to just leave. I mean, if he bought their crap and their garbage, then he should have been out of there. Okay, so the letter continues. "If I had ignored and broken the law, the Democrats would have used that to severely damage the president." Now, I mean, this is just the height of absurdity. They used a multi-year investigation, not just to damage the president, but to damage the institution of the presidency, to damage our country. So he was worried that he had not recused himself, what, that he'd gotten a few bad editorials in the New York Times or the Washington Post. But like, I mean, you talk about the damage to our country that resulted from his lack of leadership. It is really quite something that he had the nerve to write that in a letter to the people of Alabama. And then this is sort of how the letter closes. "I've always stood up for him and I never backed down, not even for one moment." I mean, like, give me a break. I can't believe he has the nerve to write that. He did not always stand up for the president. He could have said that this basis for recusal is obnoxious and absurd, and I am the ultimate leader of the Department of Justice as the confirmed attorney general, and it's nonsense and I'm not doing it. But he didn't do it. And he says, "I never backed down." He absolutely backed down. He had the opportunity to pull the recusal, and he backed down when we called for him to do it. And frankly, I think he would back down again if he were in the government. So, Jeff Sessions' letter, some real revisionist history. Thanks for listening to Hot Takes with Matt Gaetz. We'll be back tomorrow with another episode.